It's next. It's not this Motzei Shabbos. Lech Lecha. It's the one after it. Okay. Just don't want anyone getting lost. Okay. Before we start with a number of questions, just want to share with you. You know, we're basically just about ready to start recruiting season. In about a week or so, some of the Rebbeim are starting to travel already, going to the States. And then from now on, from about mid-November, basically till March, the Rebbeim coming and going, people coming to visit. We've had enough of you guys, and we're already focused on next year. So good luck. But I just want to, in case you have like friends or brothers that are maybe interested in yeshiva, so I just want to share with you, and you can share with them. I may also share with them at some point. Just the most common mistakes guys make on interviews. Not most common mistakes. Number one, it's not in any order per se, but a number one mistake guys make on interviews is when they wear that t-shirt that says, "I'm not lazy, just energy efficient." It doesn't work so well on the interview. The other thing is a little immature, but whatever, guys are 17. Picking your nose and flicking it, never worked. There's a classic story when it was the interviewer who did it. It's another time. So, but I'm not going to tell you to be immature and talk about the guy and say like passing gas during the interview. I'm not that immature to say that. But don't make the mistake of when the rabbi's chair squeaks, asking if he did. It's not whatever. It was a squeak. I don't know what he was thinking. Okay. Muttering "yeah, right" every time the rabbi says something. Okay, number five is not knowing the name of the sefer you're learning. Many of you know what I'm talking about. And there was a classic story. I used to work in another yeshiva, but can't say it because we're being recorded. So it was in that other yeshiva. So one of the guys that was in the yeshiva, he told me this great story. It's one of the high schools that's some guys went to from here. Whatever, I'm not going to say. Dearest in existence. it wasn't the top class in the senior class. So the principal walks into the class and, whatever, it's a class in disarray, and he walks in and he says, "What's going on in here? You guys haven't learned a word all year." And like everyone's like trying. He goes, "You know what? I bet no one even here can tell me what Masechet they're learning. Don't look down. I bet no one can look." And it's total silence. And then one guy goes, "Talmud Bavli?" And he's like, "Somebody, he looked! Okay, so anyways, we have a number of questions, very, very fundamental questions that I wanted to share with you in the next half hour maximum. See if we can answer any of them by the time is up. Why isn't it good enough just to be a good person? A very, very fundamental question. People can understand that there's great wisdom in Torah. People can understand that a lot of people had wonderful experiences with Pat Shabbat, learning about Judaism all over the world, and they can understand the wisdom of Torah of Judaism. But why is it just enough to be a good person? Or why is it enough just to have a good character? Why does it have to be translated into actions? Especially actions of which there doesn't seem any meaning for it. I mean, we're sort of used to it, but don't you think it's a little weird, like on Sukkot, when people are walking around with these four useless you know, agricultural things. You know, in American Valley, actually, they require, I don't know if you saw it, you got a stamp on your ESO that it can be taken into to America. They have, like, it has to be some type of a permit to take it to America. It's a weird thing. Shouldn't we agree? It's a weird thing to have a, like, carrying it around ESO with you in your hand luggage. You know, try and explain when you, if you've ever traveled, try explaining, like, you're carrying around your moving ESO and try explaining to the, you know, the TSA people what this is. You're not trying to kill somebody with this sharp object? No, it's a palm branch. Oh, okay. What are you doing with this palm branch? Oh, we wave it. You shake it. Okay. And the vertical branch? Oh, that, yeah, guess that, I paid almost 50 bucks for those. Baruch Hashem, we don't question it, most of us. But it's weird. It's weird, no? It's weird. People, it's a weird thing. It's a weird thing. They have no value whatsoever. We pay a boatload of money for it, and then the next day it has zero value. Right? The day before, you know, if you buy it, even if you bought it like 3 months earlier, it has no value. And yet, we do this thing, and we shake it, and we don't even know what we're doing. Why do we do this? Why is this important? And that's just one of many chukim that we have. It doesn't seem to that it's adding anything to my personality. It doesn't make me a better person, does it? It doesn't seem to be making me a better person. And we have many mitzvahs like this. Why isn't character building enough? Why are mitzvahs, I can understand mitzvahs in other chavero. Why isn't that enough? Does God ask question number one, let's say? Okay? By the way, almost all of this that I'm sharing with you is based on Shira Meyer from the Ramos Shapiro, who I mentioned to you another time, and his student, who you may be more familiar with, Rabbi Akiva Katz. And the book, Letters to a Buddhist Jew, is really where he really fleshes this whole Shira out. Question number two. Why do we seem that we're so petty? We're stuck on little details. Does God really care about these small details? About whether I take a little bone out of a fish when I'm eating fish on Shabbos? Or does he care on the order in which I tie my shoes? On the order in which I wipe myself in the bathroom on your business? Does he care about these things? Is it God, the master of the universe? Does he care about these nitty-gritty type of things in the Torah? There's a famous mice that happened in Hungarian parliament. Because the year that the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch came out, was published by Rabbi Shlomo Kansri, and there were a lot of Jews in Hungarian parliament. Many of them were actually non-religious Jews or anti-religious Jews. Although Hungarian Jewry was known to be very, very religious, there were some anti-religious Jews who had basically left, they became what's called a meshumah, they left the religion, and they became members of parliament. And for some reason, the discussion in parliament was all about the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and they were ridiculing some of the laws that the Jews had. And there were some religious parliamentarians who were trying to defend it. And they were saying, isn't it ridiculous that God cares about the order in which you tie your shoes? First you put on your right shoe, then you put on your left shoe, then you tie your left shoe, then you tie your right shoe. Ridiculous! So the prime minister at the time, I forgot his name, some Hungarian sounding name, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, and he said the following thing. He said, to me, it actually sounds like an amazing religion that finds meaning even in the mundane activities of going to the bathroom and tying your shoes. What an amazing image. And that quieted the debate. Question number three. And that brings us really to this week's parsha. Is that, you know, Avram Avinu is called Avram HaIvri. The Ivri, Chazal tell us, before the Hebrew language, but HaIvri because he was on one side of the world and the Tyro was on the other side. Ha'ivri. On one the Eber, the Chad, and everyone was, the entire world was, had one ideology. The entire world had one ideology, and he stood up against the entire civilized world. He went against everyone else, which is pretty amazing. It's we can't even compare it to anything in today's world, because there's so many ideologies today. There's so many things that people believe in. So no one really cares if you believe something different. Because everyone's different. Everyone's different. So you believe this, I believe that, he believes this. But the entire world believed one thing, and he believed something else. He stood up against the entire world. Now what was his kiddush? What did Avraham teach the world that was so mind-blowing, that's so different? Now if you look you read history, they'll often tell you, and even in some Jewish books, they'll tell you, Avraham Avinu, Abraham was the father of monotheism. But we know that's not true. Avraham did not invent monotheism. The belief in one God was prevalent in Avraham's time. Maybe it was even it was perhaps more widespread than any other belief, and belief in many gods. Everyone believed that there was God who created the world. You know that Noah and Abraham actually overlapped. I think we spoke about this once before. I don't know if it was in this context or somewhere else. Noah and Abraham overlapped for 58 years. After the Mabul, Noah continued to live. And for Noah, Abraham was born in the year minus 58. Okay, how long did Noah live? 600? 930. That's I think other version was 930. Lost time after. It's in the Torah, I believe. Anyone know?
Arshtol.
Okay. Avram was born 1948. Okay, Avram was born 1948. And Noah died 58 years later. You remember 58? Not to be confused with 48. Verse 23. But 58, you remember, how do you remember 58? Machia? No. Machia 1. So that's the overlap. So Noah believed in one God. Noah spoke to the one God. That was a prevalent, everyone knew there was one God. In fact, there was also yeshiva at the time. As great as, I was very warned by the applause, unsolicited applause to Torah Shraga. Thank you for that. There was yeshiva that existed before Torah Shraga, even before Volozhin. And that yeshiva was known as Yeshiva Shein Ve'eder. You may have heard of it. That's the yeshiva that Yaakov learned in for 14 years before he went to find a wife. When he was running away from Esau, he took refuge in that yeshiva. But that yeshiva existed already during the time of Noah. He had a son named Shein. And they opened this yeshiva, Shein Ve'eder. Now, I don't think he ever had 120 students in that yeshiva. No, so obviously it wasn't as popular as Torah Shraga is, but it was a serious yeshiva. So serious that he didn't have a dorm in Torah Shraga. When Yaakov was there, he didn't sleep. He was there for 14 years, and Chazal tells us he didn't sleep. Yaakov didn't sleep for 14 years. He was there in Yeshiva Shein Ve'eder. What does it mean? How do you live? It doesn't mean he didn't sleep. It means that there was no dormitory. There was no place to hide your laptop computers. There was no. I'm talking about previous years, obviously. There was no. What it means is that they spent the entire time in the baking garage. And then you got tired, you put your head down on the table, and then whatever, a few minutes later, you woke up and you were good to go. There was no dormitory. So the question is like this: what exactly did Avram? This is question number three. What was the machadish in this world if monotheism existed? What is it, the great teaching that Avraham becomes Avraham Avinu? What is he the father? What exactly did he start? Because we know that there were other people who were teaching this, but not. Like Noah, question number four, you can call it, is why did Yaakov Avinu go to the yeshiva? What were they teaching there that he couldn't learn from Avraham and from Yitzhak? And what does it mean that he didn't sleep for 14 years? Why couldn't he sleep during those years? How is that connected to the nature of that yeshiva? And perhaps this is question number five, I know we're going a little beyond what we normally do, but there are actually many, many more questions we can throw in here. But question number five, and we'll end with this question, is that, in terms of the question stage, is, you know, they tried to kill Avraham, right? Nimrod, who is the leader of this ideology that existed, that, you know, saw Avraham Avinu as a threat. Whatever he was teaching was a threat to this ideology. And so they wanted to kill him, right? They threw him to Kishon Eish. And they thought they would kill him and that would end the threat. But Avraham survived. And with all the time that they attempted to kill him, Chazal tells us that they gave up, and they said, you know what? It's no big deal. So what? So he walked into Kishon Eish, big deal. The man's 100 years old, he has no children. So he's going to die in a few years. 2 years, 200 years, whatever the case may be, and that'll be it. We don't have to worry about him. There's no future for him. And that's how they do it. Now the question is, okay, so let's say Avraham has no future. Let's just say. But what about Yeshiva Shem Eder? Why weren't they bothered by the existence of this yeshiva? Why didn't they, you know, have a forced conscription, you know, to destroy the yeshiva? My God, you should have made them all go to the Israeli army. Why don't they do that? What? Why were they okay with that issue existing? Okay? Why were they okay? Why was it not a threat to their ideology? Those are the five questions. Okay, let's try and answer these questions. And the truth is, it's a very, very simple answer. And but the idea here is so fundamental, it's so widespread in terms of everything we do, our understanding of Torah, that it may not even sound like such a big thing because it's so ingrained, it's so fundamental to what we are and what we believe. But be able to express it with clarity, then we'll clear up a lot of other questions that we haven't even shared. But you'll see, if you think about this in many, many different areas, we'll clarify a lot of different points. And that is what Avraham Avinu taught the world, is that you can take the transcendental, spiritual, otherworldly, and apply it to this world, to the physical world. That's it. That's the whole truth. What does that mean? What Avraham Avinu taught the world is that we have to connect Shemayim and Haaretz. That we have to connect the spiritual, the lofty ideas into physicality, into our flesh and bones. And this is expressed in many, many different ways and in different areas. For example, Avraham, his name Avraham in Gematria, anyone know this one? What's Avraham equal to in Gematria? 248, correct. 248, what does 248 correspond to? Limbs and bones, okay? Limbs, bones, sinews. Our entire physical body, 248 corresponds to the entire physical body. What else does it correspond to 248? Mitzvot Aseh. In other words, Avraham embodied mitzvot Aseh. There is a mitzvot Aseh that corresponds to every living body. There's a sefer called Sefer HaCharedim, okay, which is studied by all types of Jews, not unique to any one type of Jew. But the Sefer HaCharedim, it's a sefer of mitzvot, and what it does is it shows the corresponding mitzvah to the limb. Every one of the mitzvahs Aseh has a corresponding limb to it. Okay? For example, here's a hard one. What does Los Asura Akarei Nishem correspond to? every mitzvah I say, looks as it corresponds to a part of the body. So when Abraham said, Abraham 248, limits the body, the spiritual wisdom has to be translated into the physical body and expressed by the physical body. Bris, Mila, which is actually, Chazal tells us that Abraham intuited the entire Torah. Okay, the entire Torah he kept, even though he wasn't commanded in, he kept the entire Torah. Even the mitzvah of Rabbanim, he included it, exactly how he did, he was a smart guy. But he was able to look inside himself and understand himself in such a understand the wisdom, the esoteric wisdom. Perhaps when they were teaching the Yeshiva Shem Eber, they weren't learning Torah as we know it. They weren't learning the Sukkot like we know it. Okay? We'll get into what they were studying in a minute. But he was able to do the entire Torah. That was one mitzvah he didn't keep until he was commanded. But it's on one time shot. And that's the mitzvah of Bris Milah. He didn't keep it until he was commanded. Because he knew better to keep a mitzvah that you're commanded than to do it voluntarily. Something also included in itself. The word bris corresponds to what number? 612! So close! Right? 612. Why? Why 612? Because actually, bris is all the other mitzvahs, Chazal tells us, are included in the mitzvah of bris. And then there's the mitzvah itself, the bris mila itself, 613. All the other mitzvahs, all 612, is included in the bris mila itself. In other words, bris mila is the ultimate expression of the spiritual being expressed in the physical. It is the place, that is the most physical part of our body. It's the place that's the most earthy. That's the most animalistic. And it's there that we give expression to the spiritual. And really, all the other mitzvot, that's the paradigm for all the other mitzvot in the Torah. There's a sefer called Mitzvot Hashavuot, sefer by Rav Shlomo Volbig. Rav Shlomo Volbig was one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Baal Musar of his time. And passed away about 10 years ago. And he was Mashiach and Shibir in Kol Torah and Gai Yagana on the Chobot Hiskah and other places he taught. Other places he did Yeshua here, many places. He was the preeminent Baal Musar. And he wrote a sefer called Mitzvah Hashavuot, and which was his own personal Musar. It was not published during his lifetime. It was published only after his lifetime. It was his personal Musar sefer. We're going to talk about later on, Shabbat, I was talking about writing your own personal Musar sefer. Okay, I don't know if all of you guys are ready for this yet, but this is what this is his own personal thing. He didn't share with anybody else. And people begged, and finally his family agreed to release this sefer, something that he looked at and studied every day. And he wrote himself. What is this? What is the sefer? It's sefer going through the mitzvah of Shavuot, those mitzvahs that correspond where Chazal say, and one of them you learned about already in the 13th parak of Ksubas, those mitzvahs that are Shakula Kinegit Kola Tarakula, which we're referring to, you learned about? Yishu Be'eretz Yisrael is Shakula Kinegit Kola Mitzvah Shuvah Torah. The mitzvah of living in Yisrael is equal to all the other mitzvahs of the Torah. Now, that would be very nice if that was it, but the Torah actually, Chazal tell us, there are seven mitzvahs that actually are Shakula Kinegit Kola Tarakula. So how does that mean? What does it mean? How can you have seven? I understand one, but you have seven Talmud Torah, Bris Mila, Tzitzis, there are several mitzvahs that are Shekul Kenei Kol Torah, Kol Torah. What does this mean? So he has a whole sefer going through what that means, and why these mitzvahs specifically were chosen as those that are considered equal to the entire Torah. And basically, in a nutshell, I'm not going to go into it, but basically in a nutshell, he says that these mitzvahs are paradigmatic. That from here you can learn what the concept behind these mitzvahs, you can learn to read all the mitzvahs in Torah. And that's the case of Bris Milah, certainly. The fact that we take the most physical part of our body, the
the place where we're most similar to animals, where you could even, people who are even on a lot of high levels can become animalistic and voyeuristic and destroy Torah and mikvos and anything that's holy because of this area. That's where we perform a mitzvah. And therefore, all the other mitzvahs are really an expression of that idea. Now, most of our mitzvahs are physical activities. We have very few mitzvahs that are purely in the intellect, purely mind and heart. Chovos HaLevavos was a sefer written by, you mentioned it, you fellow with Rabbi Minkus before, the Bach Yom HaTikud, a very, very important sefer. It talks about the duties of the heart, obligations of the heart. Okay? Grow up. Okay? It's... No, you do. Anyways, he says that he writes a sefer because some of these mitzvahs have been ignored. And it's true. But most of the mitzvahs in Torah are physical mitzvahs. Physical activities. Okay? Aliyah L'Rega. Lulav, sukkah, tefillin, they all require physical activity. Eating matzah, eating this, eating that, you're making kiddush. Many, many physical activities. Because it's about taking the spiritual and expressing it in the physical world. This is the Kiddush HaRabbah. What existed before is that the world believed that God existed. The world believed that God created the world. But they just thought that God was irrelevant. He is divorced from our physical world. The world of the spirit is disconnected from the world of the material, the physical. And so, on the one hand, you have people who are engaging in the most base animalistic kind of behavior, and so, because God doesn't care about this. God has nothing to say about this. The other hand, you have people who were totally ascetic, where they separated, disconnected the spirit from the physical world, and so they lived lives as monks, celibate, you know, up in the Himalayan mountains, a Tibetan monk, totally disconnected from the physical world. By the way, the Shlomo Kalba has a beautiful Torah where he compares what's in between Noah and Abraham. And he says, this is what the difference was. Noah was like, you know, Lahavdil is like a Tibetan monk. You know, he was a very spiritually high person, but he wasn't accessible to people. If he wanted to, if people came and he'd come trekking, you know, Israelis, you heard about what's going on in Nepal, people go to Nepal because they want to connect, you know, to, obviously to the physical beauty of Nepal, Mount Everest, they want to do moving heights. But also because they're looking for the spiritual, these spiritual Eastern religions. That are, you know, they have throughout the Himalayan mountains they have these, you know, these hundreds of Buddhist monasteries. And so they want to connect to the all the other worldly types of things. And that's what he compares to Havel and Noah to. That you know, people will be coming to Israel from trekking, and we're looking for the holy man Noah. They go, oh, holy man Noah, see up there on the mountain, you have to climb the mountain, and there are certain hours of the day when he comes out of meditation, and if you catch him, you'll be able to converse with him. But it's very, very rare that you know, you may have to wait for a few days until he'll be able to communicate. When you compare it to Abraham, people came and go, we're looking for the holy Abraham. And they go, holy Abraham. We don't know anybody like that. They say he's a great, this great holy man, Abraham. Abraham. Oh, you mean Abe? Oh, Abe. Yeah, he's busy waiting on people, you know, serving people food. The guy, who's there? The guy dishing out the phone? Yeah, that's it. Yeah, they must have come right now. Meaning, he was totally accessible. He was in service of other people. He was giving people feet. Like, you know, he was not concerned. That's what he was looking for. He was looking to engage people. He wasn't looking to retreat. So Avivina was looking to engage the world, engage the physical world, and to infuse it with godliness. Noach was much more focused on his own, you know, inner spirit, and, you know, communicating with God and meditating. And that's what Yeshiva of Shem Eder was. And that's why they pose no threat to that ideology. The ideology that wanted to separate the godly from the physical. Because they thought God was not relevant. God's not relevant, so I can do whatever I please. I can engage in any type of you know, physical activity, and no one has anything to say about it, and I'm okay with that. And those guys, the guys in the Malay House, do what they want. Doesn't have any influence on me. The person who was a threat was Abraham. Because he said, no, you have to live a life that connects. God is actually very relevant. He is present. He's present in everything that we do. He's present whenever we eat, whenever we sleep with our wives, God is present. And so how I sleep with my wife is important. How you eat, what you eat, is important. Anything that you do, the whole drachet of the day, every physical activity, there is something that God has to say and God is interested in. How you go to the bathroom, how you tie your shoes, it's all godliness potential. And that's what Avraham Avinu was mechadesh to the world. So what did Yaakov learn? What did he learn in that yeshiva? He learned the esoteric. He learned, you know, the very high spiritual ideas, but it was divorced from the physical world. And so that's what it meant that he didn't sleep for 14 years because they totally disconnected themselves from their bodies. They ignored the body. You have to totally focus on the spiritual. So why did he go there before facing Lavan? Because Lavan represented, and we're not going to have time to explain this fully.
I have to do it another time. But Lavan represented
the world of Sheker. Sheker, the world of untruth, is when the classic type of untruth is Echad Bepeh VeEchad BaLev. That what's expressed in the outer does not reflect what's inside. And that's what Lavan was. Lavan was a world of disconnect between body and soul. And so Yaakov had to prepare himself, going out into the house of love, and had to prepare himself in Yeshiva Shein Be'eder. 40 years correspond to the 14 years potentially. Ended up being 21 years, 20 years there in the house of love, to counteract the world, in the world of disconnect between spirit and body. He needed to be schooled in that school of thought. But the Torah of Avraham, the Torah that we keep as Jews, as his descendants, is a Torah that doesn't believe in asceticism, doesn't believe in celibacy. You know the one about the monastery right here in my house. You guys have been to my house. There's a place that you can walk there, and there are actually monks that live in this monastery. And so once there was these very big Talmud monks that were sitting, learning in one of their libraries, going over ancient texts. And the guy came running and said, "What? It says celebrate! Not celibate!" Anyways, so that world, of Christianity on one hand, that the man engaging in physical activity, in raising a family, is seen as giving in to the body and disconnecting from the spiritual, that really the ideal thing is to be celibate, or in Islam, the ideal thing is not to even own alcohol. Torah Judaism actually actually embraces, Torah embraces the physical world, but infuses it with spirituality. And that's what I'm reading Torah. And that's what the Torah is all about. And everything has a connection to be holy. And so we're looking at the Sudas, which is all about marriage, husband, wife, and there's a lot of things. You know, when I was, you know, sometimes we talk about you guys, the bands, healings, and you know, the phrase that a lot of us use, there's an elephant in the room, you know, when we're learning from Sakasudas. So some sure they talk more, they talk about elephants a lot, some sure they talk about less. The elephant in the room being the sexual union between husband and wife, that's the subject of most of the second, that we sort of like talk around. But that's the whole subject about this. And you're getting more details. Especially in this class next week. Nice friends. But that's the beauty of the Torah. The beauty of the Torah that this is called Kodesh Kodeshim. Shir HaShirim, which is a love story. It's a love story. If you read the English, it sounds pornographic. It's a love story between Jewish people after the birth. It was described as a love story between husband and wife. It is the most holy thing. It's taking again. Taking the world of God and bringing it to the world of material and physical. There is no such thing as disconnect between the spiritual world and the physical world all around. Now we can very clear to our minds. Just to close, is that one of the things, and it's a little bit to just think about this, but one of the things that we do whenever we move up a level of spirituality, we always do it over wine. We make kiddush, we go from the world of Thol to the world of Kodesh. We enter into marriage, we do it over wine. Hey, at a bris mila, we do it over wine. And the reason is because wine represents something that is beyond the physical. The word yain is gematria.
Represent that figure, that when we want to go up
up from physical to a higher spiritual state. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to always to go higher and higher. That from one Shabbos, then we make Abdullah actually over one, also the long down to the week. But we're trying to then take the spiritual of Shabbos, infuse it into our week, and then the next Shabbos will be at even a higher level. And then continue to go up the spiral, up. Getting more physical, more spiritual, infusing everything and everything can be an expression of our connection to the Shabbos. These are shirts from on your way to your guide, we're not sure about it.